Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. What if the act of viewing an artwork, not a casual glance, but a single-minded viewing of the form, focus, the perspective, the use of light and darkness, and the artist's intent, what if all that could help us in making complex decisions in our workplace? Well, the perception gained from the focused viewing of art has helped professionals in government, the military, law enforcement, medicine, technology, and a range of businesses from hospitality to finance. Amy Herman has led her Art of Perception workshops for these fields and more as a way to viewing complex workplace decisions with the same parameters we view a complex work of art. Former head of education at the Frick Collection helps viewers hone their perceptive powers and eliminate biases, consider alternative viewpoints, break down complex problems into component parts in order to make better decisions. Her book, Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving, uses around 100 images of famous paintings, sculptures, mixed media, and photography to use the artistic process in order to create a new viewpoint in our own problem solving, or as a better way to critically view art for its own sake. Amy Herman is an art historian and attorney and the founder and president of the Art of Perception. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Amy Herman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
In your book, Fixed, you help readers in sort of a twofold way. One, from going from simply looking at a piece of artwork to viewing and examining art, which I think is useful on its own. But also, you apply that process to critical decision-making in business and a whole range of professional fields. The questions you ask, that you repeatedly ask viewers and readers through the book, are these the normal questions curators and artists ask when evaluating an art piece?
I don't think it is. I'm an art historian, and I'm also a lawyer, and I've tried to think about critical thinking and critical inquiry from both of those professions. And I find that the legal analysis is much more pragmatic. So in trying to combine those two ideas, I wanted to use art as sort of a fresh set of data and use it to help us rethink how we're asking questions. Because we're living in such a complicated world with so many problems that, you know, yesterday's solutions aren't going to solve tomorrow's problems. So why not try something new? So I've stepped away from the curator and the art historian way of looking at work of art, not who did it, when was it done, and what was the precedent, but leaning more towards the objective of what do you see, what's missing, what caught you off guard, and what's compelling. And those tend to be different kinds of questions than art historians ask when looking at a work of art.
That's surprising to me. I think that's exactly what people are looking for out of a work of art. Why is it important? Why is it important to go up on the walls? And in most museums, wall space is at a premium, so there has to be something special about that work. And there has to be questions about, you know, what is the first thing you think when you look at this piece of art? What's your feelings, negative or positive, towards this work? You know, trying to discern an artist's motivation. I think so many times when we go to a museum, we're basically relying on the curatorial judgment of what this artwork means. You know, we look at the piece and then we go to the little paragraph next to it to understand what it is instead of thinking about it ourselves.
That's exactly, I have the same issue. You articulated it so well. And for classes that I teach in person in museums, I don't let my classes read the label. Eventually they can, and I'm not suggesting that the label is superfluous. But what I found happens is that when you read a label, you're going to look at the work of art looking for what the label is telling you to look for. And I want people to rely on their own inherent sense of observation, because we all have it. You know, when you go into a board meeting, or you go into a hospital room, or you go into a classroom to meet with your child's teachers, there's no wall label telling you what to look for. And you need to rely on your own critical thinking and your own observation. And we all have it. And I want to help people draw that out to help them not only solve problems, but negotiate everyday situations that may be problematic. Look at all we're facing right now. There is no wall label that goes with COVID. You know, we're out there. And I want to help people rely on their own sense of observation and visual intelligence. And what I tell people in an art museum, sure, read the label, but read it after you've had a chance to look at the work of art yourself and decide what you see and then read what the curator has said.
Now, you were an art educator for a number of years before you began doing these art of perception presentations, which is the foundation of the book. And you do it to all sorts of professionals looking for ways to alter their viewpoint and intuitive assessments. And that ranges from military and law enforcement, medicine, many other professional groups. How did these presentations come about? How did you move from presenting information about an artwork in a museum setting to going out into the community and talking to professional groups?
Well, there were a couple of steps, but it really happened very quickly because, as I realized looking back, the whole process was so logical. And when I was at the Frick Collection, which was the museum I worked in the education department after I left the private practice of law, I started working with medical students, exclusively medical students, because it was a program they were already doing at Yale. And the idea was so simple. Let's take medical students out of a clinical setting, out of a hospital, bring them to an art museum, change their environment, because I believe when you change your environment, you change the way you see things, teach them how to analyze works of art so that when they return to that clinical setting, the hope is that they'll be better observers of their patients. And so I did that for a couple of years with Yale's very gracious permission because they started the program. And in 2004, I had this revelation that this applies to far more people than just medical students. It applies to so many different professions that I cold called my local police department, the NYPD. And I said, look, I have this idea. I train medical students to enhance their observation skills by looking at works of art. And I think you should send homicide detectives to the art museum. Well, you can imagine that was like a lead balloon going into the NYPD. But they transferred me so many times, and I finally got to someone who heard what I was saying. And 6 months later, every newly promoted captain in the NYPD had to come to the art museum. And then it was in the Wall Street Journal, and one thing led to another. And before we knew it, we were in hospitals, doctors, nurses, the FBI, Navy SEALs. And it just exploded because I realized everybody looks for a living. Everybody needs their visual intelligence. So it started with medical students and blossomed from there.
And along the way, you learned lots of interesting dynamics that appear. Like I think you were doing some work with nurses and you found about how the divide between older nurses and younger nurses and negotiating conflicts between them. I found that really interesting.
I found it interesting too. And I couldn't believe it when I first heard about it. Because when one hears about nurses, you think about kind, compassionate, and safe care when we're at our most vulnerable. And when I started working with nurses, they explained to me that there's something called lateral violence. And I said, lateral violence, what is that? And it's basically microaggression and bullying within the nursing field. A senior nurse, or I should say a seasoned nurse, is not trained in the digital world the way young new nurses are. And young new nurses don't have the experience that senior nurses have. As one of my senior nurses said, a good nurse should smell infection when they walk into a room. Well, how does a young nurse know how to smell infection if they don't have the experience? So hospitals called upon me to help with this bullying problem, and it's national. It's not just one city or one hospital. And so I'm using art to smooth out the edges between seasoned nurses and young nurses and give them an opportunity to air their insecurities and their fears, all while looking at art together. And it's been really eye-opening for me because most people are not aware of lateral violence because nurses show so much compassion, but not always to each other. And so I've been called upon by many nursing departments and lots of different hospitals to help combat the problem.
Well, it's interesting. As I was reading that section, I was thinking about, you know, that probably applies to a lot of different fields where you have a generation of digital natives moving into a professional situation with people who are digital transplants, who only learn computer and the digital world as adults.
That's exactly right, Rich. Once I started seeing, for lack of a better word, this chasm in nursing between the seasoned and the digital natives, you're absolutely right. It applies in so many professions across the board, from financial services to intelligence. I mean, to national intelligence. You have some of our most senior military officials in our country are not comfortable using digital, you know, digital analytics and using information and global information. And we can't hit a concrete wall. These professions are too important and lives depend on them. So we have found sort of this neutral, non-threatening territory. Let's use art as a new kind of visual data to soften those edges and bring the groups together. And most importantly, let each group show its strength to the other and let them share resources instead of pulling back and isolating those resources.
Well, during the course of the book, you use a whole range of artworks to have the reader acknowledge their biased view from an alternative perspective, to learn the artistic process and apply it towards problem solving. But there's one piece of artwork you return to throughout the book, and that is Jericho's The Raft of the Medusa, which is a stunning image. It's on my bucket list to go to the Louvre and see it in person, but it's like a huge canvas, and it has a compelling backstory. It is based on a real incident. Why that particular artwork do you keep coming back to through the book?
Well, for a couple of reasons. You're absolutely right. It's a scene. It's a harrowing scene of the aftermath of when a ship ran aground. And both the content of the painting and how it was created served as a wonderful, for me, infrastructure to plan the book around. In short, the story behind the painting is that a ship ran aground off the coast of Mauritania in 1816, and it was because of the incompetence of the captain, and people were thrown to a lifeboat. You know, all the upper classes in the military, they went on the lifeboat, and there were 147 people thrown onto a raft. And 13 days later, all but 15 of those people had died. And it was reduced. I mean, they were reduced to starvation and dehydration and even cannibalism. I mean, it was just this awful political scandal in France in the 19th century. And the artist Jericho decided to paint it. And he had to choose a moment because he, you know, his reputation, this painting, as you said, it's huge. It's 23 by 16 feet. And he decided to depict it knowing that it would be dangerous in the government to depict the incompetency of the captain that reflected on the monarchy. And there were so many parallels to today. Everybody's critical of the government, you know, 4 years ago now. So how did Jericho decide to take all this information and create a painting? So there was problem solving with the content. It was a terrible scandal. And then I followed the process of how Jericho created the painting. And it gave me the template to give readers of my book a different way to think about problem solving. Jericho had to, you know, gather so much information and learn about what happened and then paint it and create this huge painting. And there were so many aspects, so many harrowing aspects about the painting. It's certainly a difficult painting to look at, but both in substance and content, it gave me this wonderful infrastructure to give readers a different kind of template to think about their own problems. Happily, most of us don't have things as harrowing as, you know, people dying on a raft, but we're facing some really difficult circumstances. And, you know, I wanted to give people a new, fresh way, and the artistic process just seemed ripe for it right now.
My guest today is Amy Herman, and she is the founder and president of The Art of Perception, a professional development course. Previously, she was the head of education at the Frick Collection in New York City, and her book is titled Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. It's published by Harper Wave, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you take us through that artistic process, the preparation, the drafting, and the exhibition. Those are the sort of large-scale subjects of how an artist prepares to make an artwork. But within it, there are a number of steps, and it's everything from looking at your internal biases, altering your perspective to see something from another viewpoint, you know, drafting, you break it into bite-sized pieces, recognize the relationships. Can you take us through the process of how we can look at art and apply it to, you know, a given problem that we're facing in our workplace?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As you said, the book is broken down into prep, draft, and exhibit. And when we're trying to solve problems, we need to think about a lot of things before just diving in and saying, okay, let me solve this. So we have to prepare, you know, all the possible solutions, think about all the information we have. We have to draft it. You know, the first time, rarely does something succeed the first time around. And as you said, there are these sub-contexts, these sub-sections to break down our information. And I think the overarching goal for me in having readers think about the artistic process and looking at work of art is, I'm going to use a quote from Henry James. He said, try to be the person on whom nothing is lost. And rather than alter people's view, I want to broaden people's view. I want to give them the opportunity to take in as much information they can during that drafting process. How do you manage contradictions when things don't add up? And one of my favorite things that I talk about in the book is repairing our mistakes with gold. And one of the things that I think we can all do, especially now at the moment, is to bring our mistakes to the fore. You know, nobody wants to talk about what went wrong, but I think it's crucial to problem solving. And in Japan, they have this process, artistic process called kintsugi. And what they do is they take broken pottery and cracked pottery, and instead of throwing it away, they fill those cracks in with gold. And it makes the final product that much more beautiful because each piece is unique. And I think in terms of problem solving, we're gonna make mistakes along the way, we're gonna falter, but let's bring those to the fore. Let's make those mistakes part of the solution. So not only does it honor the struggle that we went through to solve the problem, we save other people the trouble of making those mistakes by saying, look, we did this, it went wrong, don't you make the same mistake. And so it's looking at the problems in a multifaceted way because, as I said before, we live in a complex world. There's so much information, nothing is simple. Look what we're facing, vaccines, boosters, kids, school, teachers, work shortages, supply chain problems. Nothing is easily solvable. And if we can break it down into these digestible pieces, if we can set reasonable deadlines and celebrate small accomplishments, the problem isn't so looming anymore. We can solve small pieces along the way, which is what artists do, what Jericho did in trying to paint the Raft of the Medusa. Small pieces, reasonable deadlines, mistakes are made, recognize that and work it into your final solution. And one of the things that I want to be the biggest takeaway from the book is don't let perfection be the enemy of good. Good is good. And we barely solve problems perfectly. Let's do the best we can and make it good and really not strive for perfection all the time.
One of the interesting techniques you mentioned, kintsugi, another one that you, it's good for just how do you look at art, but also it could be used as a technique to think about a different problem, and that is Notan study. I hope I'm saying that right.
Yes, you are. Notan studies, yes.
So Notan is basically you're looking at an artwork and you're looking at the light parts and the dark parts.
Yes, it's breaking down. Even though I say we never live in a black and white world, it's a good place to start. Let's break things down into their simplest elements. And what a Notan study does is it looks at the light and the dark to give you the mere outline of the problem. And when I started researching the Notan studies and I looked at how many different artists and how many even contemporary artists use Notan to break down a landscape, a complex scene into light and dark, and then they fill it in. And it's a way for us to look at the problems. You know, what information do we have? What are we missing? What do we know? What don't we know? And then we can fill in with the shades of gray and the subtleties. And the Notan study I find is applicable far outside the art world. How do we look at things objectively first and then fill in the subjectivity? And it goes to one of my teachings in my class. I tell my participants, it's so important to say what we see before saying what we think, because we need to lay the groundwork for what's it first, what's in front of us, then talk about what we think about it, because no one's in your brain. We should never start by saying, well, I think this. How about this is how I see the problem, and this is what I think the solution might be.
It's interesting. The real life example you use with Notan studies is, and this is, you know, we probably at one point used Yelp or TripAdvisor, and, you know, people can create, they're all, everyone's a critic now. And, you know, and for a business that can be make or break, you know, one bad review, well written, can become, you know, the verdict on your restaurant, on your hotel, on whatever. And it's interesting, this idea of using Notan study to figure out how to respond. And instead, because you can't respond to every review. And the solution was really elegant. Tell us that solution.
Well, it's, you know, it's so interesting when we think about the Notan study and putting things in black and white. And just as you were talking, I was thinking about responses. And as you said, everyone's a critic, Yelp, TripAdvisor, even Amazon. How often do we read reviews of products before we buy them for ourselves? And one of the things that we have to keep in mind, and I've thought about this since the book was published, many, many people don't write anything unless something goes wrong. You know, they're more tempted to write when something goes wrong. And the idea of how you respond, again, is processing the information. What is the response that's most harmful to your company, your hotel, your restaurant? And how you choose to respond directly and how you use someone else's words and how you're going to remedy the situation instead of saying, oh, I've gotten this terrible review. What am I going to do? Am I going to invite, 50 people to put positive reviews? But how you look at the issue that's hurting you, going directly into what you perceive as most harmful and responding to it can really have a tremendous effect. But it means breaking down the good, the bad, your responses, and how carefully we choose our words.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think the response was that you picked the best reviews and the worst reviews, and you respond personally to them. And oftentimes, because just that idea of responding personally does the trick.
It does do the trick. And when you read through these responses, or you read through the reviews, and when you see that the owner or the entrepreneur or whoever it is has taken the time to respond and respond substantively instead of just saying, well, I'm sorry you had a bad experience. You say, we've really looked at our mattresses. You complained about the mattress in the hotel and we've replaced them. It's how you choose. And as you pointed out, we can't respond to everything. We can't. We don't have the bandwidth. And so by picking the most positive and the most negative, thanking those people for their responses and choosing how you respond to those people, most people will fall in the middle of those two. And it ends up being efficient and effective because you're addressing the best and the worst. And most people will fall in between and make their own decision based on your response, not just the critique.
My guest today is Amy Herman. She's the founder and president of The Art of Perception, a professional development course which came out of her work in museum education. She was previously a head of education at the Frick Collection in New York City. And her new book is titled Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. It's published by Harper Wave. And it asks us to perfect that fine art through the viewing and examination of fine art. And what's really interesting is that you're using pieces that go back hundreds of years, some cases thousands of years, to very modern works, to abstract expressionism, conceptual art. There's something we can take out of each of these types of art to apply to a problem-solving situation. Conceptual art strikes me as interesting. I mean, that's all about how a person views, oftentimes the conceptual piece is entirely ambiguous. It's up to the individual to discern meaning oftentimes. How would you use conceptual art to help us on an aspect of problem solving?
One of my favorite artists who uses conceptual art a lot is the artist Yayoi Kusama. And I have an example of her art in the book. And what she does is one of the things that she creates, it's called an infinity room. And you walk in and it's a room of mirrors and polka dots. And it's quite disarming when you walk in because it's often bright colors, polka dots, and mirrors, and you don't quite know where you are. And by making art experiential, which is what so much of conceptual art does, is it personally affects you because you have to reorient yourself and think about your situational awareness. You have to say, okay, where am I? Where's the door I came in? And what am I looking at? And, look at all these polka dots and the colors and the mirrors. And while it can be disarming, I think it replicates so many situations we have every day. We're traveling in a foreign city. We're going someplace where, COVID restrictions are different. And we have to negotiate our own situational awareness so often that using conceptual art forces us to do that in a fun, non-threatening way. I like to think that conceptual art changes your self-perception. And that's what we have to do in real life all the time. We can't be the same and say the same things with all the different people in our lives, with our colleagues and our families and our kids and our doctors and our parents. So we are constantly shifting our self-perception and our self-awareness. And I think that conceptual art gives us a way to do that in a really fun way and a new way to look around at our surroundings.
One of the things your book does is not only sort of shares these sort of stories of artworks and helps us look at perception and understanding the problem solving matrix, but also, you talk about your work with various groups. I enjoyed the section where you were speaking to MBA security officials who, when they introduce you, everyone immediately started looking down their phone. And I imagine that's probably sometimes you get groups that go, what is looking at art going to help me in my job? So how do you overcome that bias?
Well, I remember that one distinctly because here I am in this big ballroom in Las Vegas with, you know, 200 or so NBA security officials. These are the guys who are on the court. They have an earpiece in their ear. You know, they're watching the players. They're watching for safety. They've got the GM talking in their ear. And somebody introduces me and says, well, Amy Herman's here to talk about art to help us do our jobs. And I could just see in their body language, they're like, yeah, okay, when's this going to be over? And I took the stage and I said, you know what? We're going to do a retake on that. We're going to be together for the next 2 hours. I'm the one that's in charge. We're going to look at art and you're going to leave here thinking differently about every aspect of your job. And they all looked up. You know, some of them were like, what? Who is she? And then I put a slide up and I said, okay, half of you close your eyes and half of you describe what's on the slide to your partners. And there were hands waving and yelling and they were talking and trying to out-describe each other. And they were all in after that, because I said to them, look, I respect who you are. I don't do what you do, but I want to help you do it more effectively. And I'm going to give you a new way to think about your job. Who thinks about art to look at your job? And they were all in and so much fun. You know, it's a different way. Everybody has problems. That's what we all have in common. We all have problems to solve. And here I am, just have an open mind and open eyes. And I promise you, you'll change the way you think and art's going to be the reason.
The other group that I enjoyed hearing you write about is the top secret involved with probably counterterrorism interdiction is all you can tell us. They couldn't tell you what they do. They couldn't tell you who they were. They couldn't tell you virtually nothing about them. Okay, now help us solve problems better.
The reason I included that in the book is, how many times do we have to solve a problem and we just have missing pieces? We don't have what they call this in the FBI, they call it an intel gap. You're missing crucial information and they throw you out there anyway. You got to go do what you have to do. And here's the limited information we have. And so I wanted to demonstrate that we all have missing information and yet we're still asked to perform. And so we do the best we can with the information we have. And what was the key skill for me is, how can I ask the best possible questions to get the most information that I needed to design an effective program without breaching any security, without asking anything I shouldn't be asking, and saying, well, this is what I need to know. I'm going to ask you A, B, C, and D. And as much as this book is about finding solutions and answers, it's really helping us ask the right questions. It's all about critical inquiry. And as we started our discussion, Rich, when we look at a work of art, what are the questions that come to mind? Who is this? What's going on? How do we learn to ask better questions? And that's what I hope is a big takeaway from the book for the readers.
All right. The name of the book is Fixed: How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. Amy, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Herman is the founder and president of The Art of Perception, a professional development course on using artwork to help problem solve. Previously, she was the head of education at the Frick Collection in New York City. Her new book is titled Fixed: How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. It's published by Harper Wave. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.